Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, Plato, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 4.
All of these assertions contradict common beliefs and common practice, but Plato clearly intends to do this. He was obviously aware that wrongdoing often has harsh, painful consequences for its victims, but he asserts one thing an evildoer can't do is to make a good person evil. If that were possible, it would be the very worst thing anyone could do to someone else. But it can't be done. Only we ourselves determine whether we will act justly or unjustly. Furthermore, the evildoer harms himself most of all, because wrongdoing goes against both reason and nature. Plato says that to act justly is the most important way in which man can live in accordance with nature. In this way, happiness can be achieved, too, since we're happy only when our natural inclinations and capacities are fully realized. So Plato repeatedly speaks out in the dialogues against those who look at the world around them and conclude that wrongdoing pays.
This alone stands steadfast, that we should be more on our guard against doing than suffering wrong, and that before all things a man should study not to seem, but to be good, whether in private or in public life, and that if anyone proves evil in any way, he should be chastised. Next to being good, the second best thing is to become good, and to make amends by accepting one's punishment. You may let anyone despise you as a fool and do you outrage if he wishes, yes, and you may cheerfully let him strike you with that humiliating blow, for you will suffer no harm thereby, if you really are a good and honorable man.
Plato believes that ethical actions are both reasonable and natural, but it may seem that he underestimates the powerful attraction of wrongdoing. The wrongdoer often seems to get ahead of those who act justly. Often he seems to find pleasure in his actions and their consequences. But for Plato, neither of these assumptions is convincing. He says wrongdoing brings illusory benefits. In fact, such benefits harm the receiver. The pleasure that seems to accompany wrongdoing soon becomes tyrannical. It turns into a desire for satisfaction that can never be satisfied. Here again, Plato stresses the power of reason. If people really know what the good is, they won't be able to go against that knowledge.
The lover of wisdom will himself become orderly and divine in the measure permitted to man, and a compulsion is laid upon him to practice stamping on the plastic matter of human nature, in public and private, the patterns that he envisions.
Knowledge begins with self-knowledge. Together, they provide the key to ethics for Plato. Here, as elsewhere, Plato's confidence in reason is overwhelming. He asserts that to know the good is to do the good. This means that whoever really knows what's morally right will then be impelled to do it. And the converse of this also holds. Whatever anyone does, he does because he thinks it's good. So Plato writes,
even when we slaughter, or banish from the city, or deprive of property, we do not simply will these acts. We will the good. Not what is neither good nor evil, nor what is evil. Even the worst tyrant surely does what seems good to him.
People may be mistaken in judging their own actions, but at least they think that what they're doing is right. Otherwise, Plato concludes, they wouldn't do it. How then does evil or wrongdoing happen? People do wrong, Plato suggests, not because they want to, but out of ignorance. Either they're unaware of what the good is, or they don't realize what they're doing. Maybe both.
If acting unjustly is harmful to the wrongdoer, is it not knowledge of what he is doing that would prevent this act? And does this not mean, once again, that no one voluntarily does wrong, but that all who do wrong do so against their own will?
Wrongdoing has no positive features. It's always a failure or absence. In fact, evil's not even quite real. It's a shadow of the good that might have been. People who do wrong don't act willingly or wittingly. They do so quite simply because they don't know any better. Predictably, this view of evil has consequences for Plato's conception of punishment. If a wrong were done knowingly, then punishment would be justified, either as retribution, paying back the wrongdoer, or as a deterrent, making life so painful that he won't repeat the act. But if wrongs are done because of ignorance, the wrongdoer is not really responsible for what he does. So Plato concludes his punishment should be a form of rehabilitation, educating him to recognize the true nature of the good.
The wicked man and the doer of evil is in any case unhappy. But he is more unhappy if he does not meet with justice and suffer punishment. Less unhappy if he pays the penalty and suffers punishment.
Only with this punishment and the self-knowledge it brings will the wrongdoer then become fully responsible for what he does, whether it's evil or good. Punishment then should be designed to educate, and the task here, it seems, is not very different from the more general task of leading people from ignorance to knowledge. How then can we acquire the knowledge we need to act ethically? On the one hand, if people are rational by nature, then they should also be naturally good. In Plato's view, it's reasonable to act in accordance with the good. And if people are naturally good, learning to act justly will be unnecessary. They'll already know this. On the other hand, Plato's aware that people often do act wrongly or unjustly. But the lack of knowledge that explains this also comes from inside ourselves. Nobody can give someone else the power of reason. No one can make someone else do what is wrong. Furthermore, Plato says knowledge can't simply be transferred like a message or a possession, nor can knowledge be bought or sold. In this sense, in fact, neither ethics nor anything else can be taught. This again is why Socrates wouldn't accept fees for his teaching. He didn't want people to think they could buy knowledge. Both reason and knowledge come from inside the knower. The role of the teacher, for ethics as for all other knowledge, is then only to provoke the student into teaching himself, to sting him, just as Socrates in his role as the gadfly of Athens had done in his life. Plato's so committed to this view of teaching and learning that he asks us to accept a rather fanciful explanation for it. He says people have knowledge, all knowledge, in themselves, innately. It's born in them. But for some reason, Plato suggests, at birth this innate knowledge is forgotten. Teachers, then, are supposed to remind their students of what they already know but have forgotten. Plato admits he's telling a tall tale when he says that innate knowledge has been forgotten. But he tells this story to justify his theory of teaching and learning, which is much more important to him. Plato's myth also recalls Socrates in his self-pronounced role of gadfly. He made people remember what they'd rather forget. In the dialogue entitled The Meno, Plato puts together the many pieces of this theory of learning, relating the theory to an analysis of ethics. The dialogue opens with a question Meno puts to Socrates.
Can you tell me, Socrates, whether virtue can be taught? Or if not, does it come by practice? Or does it come neither by practice nor by teaching? But perhaps people have it by nature, or in still some other way.
How, in other words, does a man become good or virtuous? Socrates responds characteristically by challenging Meno's assumption that he already knows what virtue is. He urges Meno to answer that question before going on to consider whether virtue can be taught or not. And Meno shows that Socrates' doubts are well-founded. He first tries to define virtue by offering a list of examples.
A man's virtue is to manage public business, to help friends and hurt enemies. A woman's virtue is to manage the house well and keep the stores all safe and obey her husband.
Socrates quickly notices Meno's mistake. You can't define what something is by giving examples of it, because you need the definition before you can find the examples. Otherwise, how would you know where to look? Socrates asks Meno,
suppose I ask you what a bee is. What is its essential nature? And you replied that bees were of many different kinds. What I want you to tell me is not that they are different, or even how they are different, but how they are all the same.
In Plato's view, Meno's made a common error. This error is evidence that general principles exist. Plato says particular examples imply that there is something common among them. The goal of all science is to determine what that common something is. This is true for all kinds of knowing. So it also applies to the understanding of ethical or moral values like justice or courage or piety. So it's crucial to discover what this group of ethical qualities have in common. But this is not easily accomplished. Meno himself points to one difficulty when he describes a dilemma that might block the way to all knowledge and learning.
How will you try to find out something, Socrates, when you have no notion at all of what it is? If you meet it by chance, how will you know this is that which you did not know?
In other words, if you know something, you don't have to learn it. If you don't know it, you won't be able to recognize it when you do learn it. According to this dilemma, learning of any sort would be impossible. Socrates responds first by telling Meno a myth he's heard. Then he gives what amounts to a practical demonstration of the myth. The myth, according to Socrates, describes the soul or mind as immortal. And if a soul is immortal and rational, it knows everything that can be known. More exactly, everything knowable is included in the soul. When the soul's born into a body, however, it forgets what it's previously known. The knowledge is still there, but the newborn infant doesn't have access to it. The infant then seems to begin anew from the beginning. But in fact, the way it learns is by a process of recollecting or remembering what it previously knew. In this sense, learning and teaching do not provide the student with new information. They only prod him to recall what he already knows. Socrates provides an example of what he means here by giving an impromptu geometry lesson to a slave boy who belongs to Meno. He encourages the boy to answer some questions and claims that the boy finds in himself the geometric proof they eventually produce. Socrates, with his reminders, clearly asks what we would call leading questions. But he emphasizes to Meno that the boy's answers come not from Socrates or from any other external source. The answers come from the boy himself.
And no one having taught him, only asked questions, yet he will know, having got knowledge out of himself.
At this point, the dialogue with Meno shifts back to the question from which it started. What is the relation between ethics and knowledge? Plato suggests that ethical knowledge can be recovered from the self through questioning. Accordingly, it must be related to knowledge at a more general and basic level. But what is this relation? Socrates prods Meno to consider the ethical qualities that are usually valued most highly: justice, courage, temperance. Isn't it true, Socrates asks, that they all presuppose at least one thing in common? Knowledge.
For example, courage. If courage does not involve intelligence, would not the boldness associated with courage turn into foolhardiness? Isn't it true that to be confident without reason does a man harm, whereas reasoned confidence helps him?
Plato makes a common sense point. It'd be foolish never to back away from a situation. In some circumstances, to back away, even to run away, is the prudent, the right thing to do. A genuinely courageous man will recognize this. Courage, then, consists in knowing what to fear and what not to fear, and then acting on that knowledge. The same argument applies to all other moral virtues. Knowledge also has a central role in each. And if virtue presupposes knowledge, then, Plato seems to conclude, virtue can be taught. Even the most forgetful soul should be able to remember virtue, and this would be true for everybody. No one is unteachable. The discussion between Socrates and Meno, however, doesn't end with this conclusion. Socrates is still not convinced that Meno fully understands what it means to teach somebody something. He proves this to the reader and to Meno by seeming to contradict his own first answer, that virtue can be taught. Then Socrates watches how Meno reacts. Plato now argues for what seems to be the opposite conclusion from his earlier position. If virtue is knowledge and can be taught, he challenges Meno, surely there ought to be people who teach it. But in fact, as we look around Athens, we don't find such teachers. Indeed, there are people who claim to teach ethics, but they don't really do this. Their students frequently turn out badly. Indeed, even the children of good parents often turn out to be unjust. It seems obvious if anyone would want to instill ethical values, parents would want to instill them in their children. Contrary to the first conclusion, then, common perception tells us that virtue is not, in fact, taught. It does not seem to be knowledge, and Socrates questions Meno on this point.
Can you name any other subject in which the professed teachers are not only not recognized as teachers of others, but are thought to have no understanding of it themselves, and to be no good at the very subject they profess to teach? When people are so confused about a subject, can you say that they are in a true sense teachers?
With this question, the dialogue draws to an abrupt close. Meno, and we as well, are left hanging. We are left to ponder the apparent contradiction that Plato seems to have asserted. Virtue both can and cannot be taught. Virtue both is and is not knowledge. But Plato's left a clue in his text. A clue which Meno himself in the dialogue misses. In the first part of their discussion, Socrates and Meno consider the relation between ethics and knowledge in general. They don't discuss the specific knowledge that's required to be good or just. When Socrates later asserts that there are no teachers of ethics, however, he's referring specifically to the people who pass for teachers in Athens. That they are not true teachers doesn't mean that there could not be others who are. Socrates himself has taught geometry to the slave boy. In the same way, he's taught ethics to the Athenians, by his own example and by questioning. For Plato's audience here, the message is clear. Ethics is a form of knowledge, and it can be taught. But we must first understand what knowledge is. We must genuinely understand what it means to teach and to learn. It's easy to be mistaken about both knowledge and learning. Socrates has shown Meno and us how at least some of our common mistakes can be avoided.
This is the end of part 4. Please download part 5 to continue.